Have you ever wondered what Amsterdam is all about? Don't just read about the culture that has accepted cannabis. Experience it firsthand with CS Travel's Sensible Amsterdam Tour with Normal. Travel to one of Europe's most beautiful cities this January for an educational and recreational visit to a city that regulates cannabis like alcohol. CS Travel has arranged an exclusive visit for reform-minded Americans that includes a private tour of some of Amsterdam's most renowned coffee shops, educational seminars with coffee shop proprietors, local law enforcement, members of the Cannabis Retailers Association, and Normal staff. Entertainment includes a special evening at the Boom Chicago Comedy Club, canal tours, visits to the city's many museums, including the world-famous Van Gogh Museum. Don't just wonder about Amsterdam, experience the beauty and freedom of this unique city firsthand with CS Travel and Normal Sensible Amsterdam Tour. Pricing information is available online at coffeeshoptravel.com. That's coffeeshoptravel.com. Or call toll-free at 800-816-1846. That's 800-816-1846. Be a sensible American. Visit Amsterdam with CS Travel and Normal this January. Call 1-800-816-1846 right now to book your trip. More information is available at normal.org. Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to Normal's Daily Audio Stash today. It's Wednesday, October 10th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal right now to help end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit NORML.org to make your donation or join Normal today. In our audio stash today, we'll have our regular weekly cannabis science segment with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Mitch will be at the Normal Conference this Friday and Saturday in Los Angeles. You can still register online. I believe today is the last day you can do so. So make sure to link up to the Normal Conference right up on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Also on the program today, Houston-based radio broadcaster Dean Becker joins us today. We're going to talk to Dean about his work and also play some audio from one of his recent programs featuring Judge James Gray. He's a sitting judge out in California. We'll hear Judge Gray talk about marijuana in California specifically. So Dean Becker and Judge James Gray here on the program today. Let's open up our audio stash with our cannabis science segment. Dr. Mitch Earlywine joins us each Wednesday here for our Cannabis Science segment. Mitch is author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. He's editor of the book Pot Politics, and you can catch a monthly column for Mitch in High Times magazine. We have links to his books at normalaudiostash.com. Mitch, welcome back to the show today.
Oh, happy to be on, Chris.
Great to speak with you again today, Mitch. We're going to run into each other in just a few days here at the annual Normal Conference out in L.A. Friday and Saturday. Mitch, you're presenting on a couple of panels there. Tell us about the subjects you're going to address.
Well, I'm really excited about both my talks. The first one is about marijuana and mental illness, and I'll get a chance to review some of the psychosis literature we've talked about before, as well as some really confused links about marijuana and depression, marijuana and a motivation and things like that. And I'll, you know, just help folks sort through that literature. And then the second talk is essentially based on my new book, Parents' Guide to Marijuana, and it's about talking to teens about why they might choose to wait before they start using cannabis.
Righto, and we've discussed the psychosis literature here in our segments in depth. A lot of that comes from the UK rather than the US.
It's my impression that particularly the longitudinal data sets are more accessible in, you know, the European countries, so you see folks don't move around as much, they're easier to follow and things like that. It makes for a big opportunity. There's also a splendid longitudinal data set in New Zealand that's one of the most impressive of all of these. But the take-home message is there's really only 7 good longitudinal studies in that recent meta-analysis that was in, you know, a prominent medical journal, and that really only one of them looked at schizophrenia per se. The rest of them were more about psychosis more broadly defined, and I just want to make sure that people understand that there isn't as much here as some of the UK newspapers may have led us to believe.
And why is it so important for those within the reform movement to understand this data and some of the misconceptions around it?
I think the key is we're also used to talking to each other, and we all had such an implicit understanding about cannabis and its potential for negative consequences. But folks who aren't immersed in this the way we often are don't really understand. So they hear you smoke one joint and you become schizophrenic, and they believe it. And in fact, when you take a look at the size of the effect in that literature, it's really nowhere near large enough to even make a big deal out of. And when you start explaining to folks that, look, these studies, most of them really don't even look at schizophrenia, then I think the cogs really start turning. And if we do this in an informed way, it ends up making us look better, and it really helps the movement look like it's really about justice and not about marijuana. And that's really a message I think folks who aren't users and folks who aren't behind changing policy can start to understand.
Also, Mitch, I wanted to ask you this, since we're headed out to California this week. Drug czar John Walters was in Southern California last week, and he took time specifically to try and dispute the word prohibition being used in relation to his agency's actions. I certainly think the word prohibition fits, especially for marijuana. I wanted to know your thoughts on this terminology.
Absolutely. In fact, anytime you've got a law that says, look, people are no longer allowed to access this product, that's prohibition. I think Walters is smart enough to know that when people hear the word prohibition, they think of alcohol prohibition, and it was a huge, giant failure. And we all sort of know in our hearts that prohibition just can't work because it's just completely counter to human nature. And so he wants to separate himself from that term in order to, you know, keep the drug war going. But as soon as we realize, hey, this is really prohibition, this is saying, hey, you cannot have access to these products, just like it was in alcohol prohibition. And in fact, the negative consequences have been worse than they were for alcohol prohibition, in part because this war has just gone on so long.
Walters did try to say it wasn't like alcohol prohibition because even in the 20s, alcohol was a socially accepted thing to consume. Yeah, we know that 94 million Americans have tried marijuana at least once. Do you feel marijuana smoking is essentially socially accepted here, Mitch?
Again, I think we're seeing it. It may vary with generation. It may vary with age. It definitely varies with education, so that people with more education are often more accepting. But the range is really there, and there are literally, you know, tens of millions of Americans who are completely content with the idea that marijuana is less harmful than alcohol, less harmful than tobacco, and as easy to regulate as any of those others. And we shouldn't be wasting our valuable resources trying to, you know, keep people in jail or give them trouble because they own a plant.
Also, Mitch, in your upcoming book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana, I know Marsha Rosenbaum, who will be at the conference this week as well, but Marsha was both widely praised and then also caught some flack over her book, It's a Plant. What are you anticipating the reaction to your new book might be?
It's funny because Marsha, you know, she didn't write It's Just a Plant, but she did endorse it, and I was stunned at the reaction that she got because that seems such an innocuous text. Mine is a little different in focus and targeted towards parents rather than, you know, an illustrated child-looking book, so I'm thinking I should get the benefit of the doubt on that. You know, if I end up on Bill O'Reilly, he will certainly give me trouble about the message being that teens should wait rather than that they should never do any intoxicant ever in their entire lives. But I feel like the data are on my side. I present it in a way that's accessible, that people will enjoy reading. It's short. You get the point across really quickly. I'm hoping that the reaction will be really good. But in my heart of hearts, I have this fantasy that maybe somebody famous, somebody big, will get on TV and tell everybody that I'm Satan and that the book is terrible in hope of, you know, sort of generating a little controversy and getting even more attention to this issue so that people can understand that just because we want to change marijuana laws doesn't mean we want to see people use it inappropriately, and that, in fact, that is our message. Part of the appropriate use of cannabis is appropriate regulation, and once we have that, we'll have a lot more credibility when we start telling people how to use it safely, including when they shouldn't use it.
And when you approach the subject of having this discussion between parents and their children, or even parents among themselves, how do you think parents are approaching this issue already?
I, you know, don't want to pretend like I'm any kind of king expert parent. And I think part of why I was qualified to write this book is because parenting is actually really, really hard for me. And so I have a lot of empathy for folks who find themselves pulling their hair out and wanting to scream shut up and things like that, but who know that that's really not going to work. I get the sense that a lot of parents didn't intervene early with their teens, and now they're in a bigger struggle than they had anticipated having. So I talk a lot about, you know, let's make sure you get opportunities to talk about drugs as folks are growing up. And, you know, of course, that's great to say in retrospect, but if you can get the opportunity, by all means do. And then I really play out this idea that confrontation is not the tool that we thought it was. In the old days when we used to treat substance abuse problems with confronting people about their issues, it really backfired on us, and that instead cooperation and listening go much, much further. And I realize, you know, it's a hard thing to think about when you're in the middle of an argument, but in fact, simple things like listening first, letting your teens talk to you, letting your kids say their piece and tell their whole side of the story goes so much further than the finger wagging and the yelling and all of that frustrating style of interacting that in fact just makes kids hide their use from their parents rather than discuss it rationally and provide opportunities for parents to get the point across that it's worth it to wait in order to be able to keep negative consequences to a minimum.
And I think I've asked you this before, but I'd like to cover it again. What do you think is a good age to open this discussion about marijuana with kids?
In my book, I mention a little discussion I had with my daughter Dahlia when she was 4. And everybody kind of laughed at that, but it was literally Janis Joplin was on the radio. She said, "Who is that?" We talked about it, and I said, "By the way, she died from drugs." And she said, "Oh, wow, that's a drag." You know, and we were literally going back and forth about this one issue for maybe a minute. And then I'm done, right? I don't have to lecture her. I don't have to turn into a big diatribe about how she should never use drugs, but just, "Oh, gee, isn't that sad? She could sing, and it was so neat, and she didn't get to do as much as she could have done because of this problem." And then I left it at that. And if you plant those seeds really early, then suddenly this is not a taboo topic. This is an opportunity to talk about this all the time anyway. Now, I have to confess, because I wrote a book with a big pot leaf on the cover when she was 3 and she saw the Canadian flag and pointed at it and said, "Marijuana," it was, you know, clearly a big issue. And it's something we talk about a lot in my house just because it's so prevalent. But, you know, literally anybody, whether they're in the movement or not, gets these opportunities to talk about drugs on the radio, on TV, in the newspaper, kids at school, things that they're having at school. Anything, and it doesn't have to be a 20-minute talk. It can be 90 seconds here and 90 seconds there, and suddenly you're making the pathway. You're opening up this communication line, and then as things get more serious and more prevalent and as they get older, these kinds of talks are just part of any other conversation you'd be having.
Righto, Mitch. Well, very much looking forward to seeing you out in L.A. this week and recording some sit-down interviews as well as your presentations. There are a lot of people speaking. Who are you looking forward to see present there?
Well, I'm particularly excited to see Keith and to see Alan St. Pierre and you know, the time we've spent together, Chris, and I've never actually laid eyes on you, so that'll be fun as well. But I think one of the talks that I'm most excited about hearing is actually Harry Levine's discussion of these racial disparities in the arrests, and really getting into those data and talking about just how we can make the world a better place for everybody by altering these laws and making sure they're enforced in a way that doesn't discriminate against anybody.
Righto. Well, again, Mitch, very much looking forward to seeing you out there this week, and many thanks again for joining us here on the Audio Stash today.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks again, Mitch. Dr. Mitch Earlywine joins us each week here on the Audio Stash. Today was Mitch's 65th interview here on the program. He joins us each Wednesday here again. Mitch is author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. He's editor of the book Pot Politics. He's got a monthly column in High Times magazine, and as you heard, his new book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana, comes out this winter. We have links to his books at normalaudiostash.com. Stay tuned. Dean Becker from the Drug Truth Network in Houston coming up next.
Hey, is it 420 yet? This is Rick Cusick from High Times Magazine, and you're tuned into Normal's Audio Stash.
Around the country, there are a number of courageous local TV and radio broadcasters who've made the issues of marijuana reform and the so-called drug war the main focus of their programs. Today, we're going to speak with one of those broadcasters, radio personality Dean Becker of Houston, Texas. Dean's been on the air for over 5 years on KPFT in Houston, and he's won the Best of Houston Radio Award from a local paper. His programs Cultural Baggage, The Century of Lies, and 420 Drug War News are available on KPFT Weekly and on his website at www.drugtruth.net. We have links to it on our website today. Dean is a member of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and he travels around the country to record audio and video at conferences and events. He'll be at the Normal Conference this week as well, and Normal's executive staff, even myself, have appeared on his radio programs. Dean, welcome here to the Audio Stash today.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate the opportunity.
Great to speak with you today, Dean. We've run into each other at many of the events, and it's good to get you here on the program. First, Dean, tell us a bit about your background. I know you're involved with law enforcement in the past, and you've spoken out against prohibition for some time.
Yes, I am. I was a cop in the Air Force, guarding nuclear weapons mostly. But I have joined the organization Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We're a group now approaching 9,500 members worldwide. We've all come to the conclusion that drug war is an absolute abysmal failure, and we work together to end drug prohibition.
And you also produce a video for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP, and post the video online.
Yes, it has. I've been lucky enough to attend many of the drug conferences around America and able to capture them on videotape, post many of them on YouTube, also on my website, which is drugtruth.net, and make them available to other access channels around the nation for their viewers.
And, Dean, when did you first begin broadcasting there on KPFT?
Well, coincidentally, next week marks 6 years that we've been on the air. They put us on every other week at midnight. Nobody died. They put us on every Thursday at 11 p.m. Nobody died. Now we're on prime time. We're actually at 11:30 a.m., about the best time of day for radio listenership.
Dean, your work there on Houston Public Radio, KPFT, has also brought some community recognition in Houston, I understand.
Well, they have. We've gotten some awards from the local papers. We've gotten respect. Heck, even some of the major paper here. I know one of the editors tunes into my show on a daily basis.
And, Dean, you do a fair amount of traveling both in the U.S. and abroad to present these issues. Tell us a little bit about some of your travels.
Well, I've been to Canada a couple of times to talk with Mark Emery, the Prince of Pot up there, about his situation, where the U.S. government wants to extradite him to the United States. They call him the world's largest drug dealer for having sold seeds to Americans via the mail. And the most positive aspect I have from that is that I was able to see what it's like in a country where they allow medical patients, the federal government allows medical patients to use marijuana. And it's a whole lot different than what we've got going on here in the U.S., where the DEA refuses to recognize any medical applications. And as you're aware, going after the pot clubs in California and other locales for providing medicine to sick and dying patients. And I guess what it has done in my trip to Bolivia showed me that people can use the coca plant responsibly. Everyone I met down there, from the justice minister to the Christian ministers at the churches, chewed coca daily, constantly, really, and without any complications whatsoever. I think you could compare it to a mild cup of coffee. It just gives people the strength and the ability to do the sometimes very difficult work while they're starving. So coca is not a dangerous plant. It's the U.S. insistence that these smugglers turn it into a smaller product, cocaine, and ship it to our country to be distributed to our children. It's part of the reason we and LEAP work together to end prohibition, to take this back to some semblance of normalcy, of dealing with it in a responsible way.
And you've also had a lot of guests who are close to the marijuana law reform movement. What do you see as the biggest changes in marijuana law reform in the past 6 years?
Well, I think the most, I don't know, positive thing I've seen is that just people are becoming more willing to talk about the truth of the matter. The fact is, marijuana in its thousands of year history has never killed anybody. I think we've all determined that the worst thing that can happen is you might get sleepy, eat a bag of Fritos, and go to sleep. You know, it's not a danger to our society, not like it was proclaimed in the 20s and 30s by our first drug czar, Harry Anslinger. And I think it's that willingness to speak about it, to share that truth with their elected officials, with their local papers, and with their neighbors and friends, to just say, hey, it's okay. Let's don't sweat the small stuff. Let's deal with prescription drug abuse. Let's deal with alcohol, which kills a whole lot more people than all the hard drugs combined.
Dean, you're a member of LEAP, and bring on voices from that organization frequently on your programs. These are judges, police, and other law enforcement officials, both currently serving and retired. This is a very unique group of people there at LEAP. What do you think is the common thread that gets all these law enforcement personnel speaking out against prohibition?
Well, if I dare say, and I don't mean to speak on everyone's behalf, but a bit of it is guilt for having been responsible for sending thousands, and if you look at our whole group, tens of thousands of people to prison for, you know, tens of thousands of years for possessing some plant product in their pocket. And I think that motivates a lot of us to speak up, to change this, to stop the waste of lives and potential that comes about from these drug arrests. You know, the original idea was to stop the drug kingpins and the traffickers from spreading this stuff to our children, but that's not what it's turned out to be. And I think many of us work to bring this again back to a sense of normalcy, something dealing with reality. I'm proud of the list of guests. I'd like to rattle off a couple. He passed away last year, but Eddie Ellison, he was a former head of Scotland Yard Drug Division. I've had Gustavo De Grief, former Attorney General of the Nation of Colombia. As you said, Jack Cole. I've had many judges like Judge Jim Gray, Superior Court judge out there in California. And the list goes on and on. Several police chiefs, cops still working on the beat. CIA agents, DEA agents, people whose opinions we should value and respect and take into our hearts and in our decision-making process.
And you also traveled to some of the big reform events here in the U.S., like Seattle's Hemp Fest. You were down in Austin for the Freedom Rally there and at the SSDP conference last year in Washington. What do you think is the best event out there regarding reform?
Well, I would have to say, insofar as gathering of the tribes, over the years, it has been normal. It's where I think most people try to attend. It's where they get to share information and, bond together to try to come up with plans and ideas and ways to change all this. I feel that the various other conferences, the methamphetamine conference, usually held in Salt Lake City, is a powerful way to address this problem of methamphetamine and ways to change people's minds and attitudes and perhaps just the way they use these drugs so it isn't so debilitating to their bodies and minds. But insofar as the ranking of the groups, it's hard to say. From year to year they change and the focus changes, but they're all positive, and I like to share that information with my listeners.
And again, you've interviewed dozens of folks on your radio program. Let me ask, who are some of the standout interviews? Who might have surprised you?
Well, I send out a CD, kind of a sample disc to radio stations that are contemplating using my programs. And one that I always carry is my first interview with Jack Cole, the director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. I find it quite powerful, and just no way you can walk away from it without having to reflect on what he said. Now, another one that surprised me that he actually did the show was Joffrey Guy, the executive director of GW Pharmaceuticals. That's the outfit that has come up with that product that uses whole plant cannabis extracts to make this product they call Sativex. And we had a very, I won't say competitive interview, but he, let me rephrase that. We had what I would call a not exactly contentious interview, but I did get him to admit that cannabis in and of itself is not a bad product. He was telling me that if we were to come up with a perfect heat element, that cannabis in and of itself could perform the same duties as his product, Sativex. And there have been many over the years, but it's always the judges and the, I think the scientists that put forward the information that awakens my audience, gets a lot of calls to the studio wondering where they can learn more. But there, even the patients and the prisoners that I occasionally get to interview are important in that they provide a little bit of context within which to judge what's going on in this drug war.
You also have something related to the radio program called the Tin Hat, the Foil Hat Award. Tell us about this conspicuous honor you bestow on some public officials.
Well, it started about a year and a half ago, and it's the Tin Foil Hat Award, which I give to drug warriors who have shown themselves to be, just ignorant beyond belief. Some of the awards have gone to our drug czar, John Walters, to Antonio Maria Costas, head of the UN Drug Control, and also to folks like Jody Rao, the governor of Connecticut. But there have been many times over the years that I have tried to interview people in positions of power. The drug czar, I met him face to face, walked up to him, tried to hand him my business card, offered him my hand, invited him to come on my show. He looked at me like I was crazy. He stood up, his guards gathered around him, and he left the building. I have extended an invitation to everyone in my chain of command, from the drug czar down through the state and federal attorneys general, to my state and federal congressmen and senators, to the governor, the mayor, the police chief, the district attorney, and I guarantee you there's not one person on this planet willing to spend 15 minutes defending this policy of drug war. And I'm kind of proud of the fact that they all avoid me like the plague.
And I know, again, you're producing video. Are you looking to have a television program out there as well?
Well, I do have my shows air fairly regularly on the Houston access channels. I know that there have been other access channels around the country that use them on occasion. My goal, ideally, would be to make these available to any person who would just write me a letter telling me they'd like to use it. And, again, they can see all of these videos at drugtruth.net.
Righto. Well, Dean, this has been a great conversation here today. I really appreciate you taking time to join us. We're going to play a clip of your radio program here coming up next. Dean, thank you again for joining us today.
Well, I look forward to our interview on my show next week.
Looking forward to it as well, Dean. Thanks again for joining us. Dean Becker is a radio personality based out of Houston, Texas. His programs are on KPFT in Houston. They're called Cultural Baggage, The Century of Lies, and 420 Drug War News. They can be found online as well at www.drugtruth.net. We have links to it on our website today. Right now, we're going to play a clip from an August program from Dean. This is part of his Century of Lies broadcast. We're going to hear from a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP, Judge James Gray. Judge Gray has written a book condemning prohibition. He's a sitting Superior Court judge in California right now. We're going to hear him discuss marijuana in California.
Judge Gray, I know out in California, the camp, I think it is, California Marijuana Eradication Group, is now patrolling the mountainsides trying to catch the growers of marijuana. And even here in Texas, we had three, they called them major plantations, discovered up near Dallas. And all this is happening at the same time The cartels in Mexico are beginning to harvest their bud and bring it across the border. And I think it's almost unpatriotic that we're forcing people to buy the marijuana from these dangerous cartels rather than American-made. Your thoughts on that,
well,
sir?
Well, look, I go and I talk with groups a lot, and I'll tell them that the secret is that prohibition never works as well as regulation and control. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, walk down this path with me for a minute, and I think people are increasingly willing to accept this. What happens if we were to treat marijuana like alcohol? Now, first of all, I've never used marijuana. I'm not interested. I do use alcohol, and I must confess that, to my knowledge, marijuana is a dangerous drug, but really far less dangerous than alcohol. But what if we were to treat marijuana like alcohol? Dean, five things would happen immediately, all of them beneficial. The first thing that would happen is that we, at least in the state of California, could save about $1 billion of taxpayer money that now we spend in a futile effort to eradicate marijuana from our state and prosecute and incarcerate nonviolent marijuana users. I've already told you how flamingly successful we are at that because marijuana is the largest cash crop in the state today. Number two thing we could do is we could tax the silly stuff. We could generate revenue of about $1.5 billion every year, and that would have a budget deficit change for the better in our state alone every year for about $2.5 billion. I would use at least half of that money, by the way, to involve ourselves with honest education and drug treatment, which would further reduce the drug abuse. Third thing, though, would trump the first two, in my opinion, and that is that we would make marijuana less available for our children than it is today. Why? Because today, and you talk to high school kids and junior college and underage kids like I do, and ask them, you know, if I were to give you $50 in cash right now, how many of you could come back with $50 worth of marijuana by noon tomorrow? And two-thirds of them raise their hand, and the other third just hasn't thought about it. Why? Because if they want to, it's easier for them to get marijuana than it is alcohol. Why again? Because the alcohol is regulated and controlled by the government, and the illegal drugs are controlled by illegal drug dealers, and they don't ask for ID. So let's recognize that reality. The fourth thing that would happen is we would render simply out of business this whole medical marijuana issue. No, allow medical marijuana to be distributed to adults. Allow medical doctors, by the way, to prescribe medicines for their patients instead of having police make medical decisions. But that whole area in which the federal government is truly coming on like a bully, and they deserve our animosity for it, but that would simply be rendered moot. And the fifth thing is, and I hope that you and your listeners are appreciative of this, we could revitalize the entire hemp industry, which goes back thousands of years. Even in the word ancient Greek, there was the word for canvas was synonymous with the word for cannabis, and it goes back thousands of years, and there are many, many beneficial usages for hemp. In fact, we can even use hemp products here, but we have to import them from Canada, for example. Why should we put our merchants behind the eight ball? Why should we not allow them to raise the hemp here as well? So those are just for openers, and there's no negative. A lot of people today have their drug of choice as marijuana, but we almost force them, coerce them up the drug scale into using methamphetamines or cocaines because the marijuana is so much easier to detect. First of all, you know, it has that aroma, it's more bulky, and all importantly, if you're concerned about drug testing, the marijuana will stay in your body and your system for about 30 days, the methamphetamines or cocaines will stay in your system for about 3 days. So if you're concerned about being caught, message, use cocaine, use methamphetamine, don't use marijuana. That is simply a stupid thing to do, but that's what's happening today. So if we were to treat marijuana like alcohol, I'm convinced that a lot of people would come down the ladder and go back to their original drug of choice, which would be marijuana. We should do that. We repealed alcohol prohibition, but we're still living in prohibitionary times today. Today it's drug prohibition. So anytime people say, well, prohibition, what does that mean? It's either alcohol prohibition or drug prohibition, and we're reaping the same negative results from drug prohibition today that we did alcohol prohibition that everybody turns their nose up at. So I'm sorry, but that's a distinction I think we should make.
That was Law Enforcement Against Prohibition member and Judge James Gray from California on Dean Becker's radio program, The Century of Lies, from KPFT in Houston. We have links to the radio program and to Judge James Gray right up on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 420 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.